Hey, everybody. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
Today, we're going to be talking about the last session of the Human Project. This is where it's been all building up to. Just to give you a little bit of a context, if you're tuning in for the first time today, you should probably go back and start listening right from the first session. But just to give you a quick overview, the Human Project is a four-part video series that we're developing as a discussion tool, evangelistic discussion tool, where you talk about the gospel with people through the lens of our humanity. And so we've been asking the questions up to this point: what is human? What's the value of human life? And what leads to human flourishing? And finally, today, for the fourth and the final session, we will be looking at how should humans live?
And so in many ways, you should see these as extra material. If you plan on hosting the series or you wanted to know more about the series, this is one of the reasons why we've been putting these together, these four talks. These podcasts are not the Human Project. They're about the Human Project. And if you'd like to get more information about that, if you'd like to host the series, you can pick it up at thehumanproject.ca.
Yeah, and it'll be launching this March at our annual Apologetics Canada conference on March 2nd and 3rd. So you can come check us out there.
Yeah, come check it out live. We'd love to have you out. Tickets are selling quick, so make sure you grab those right away.
Yep, go to apologeticscanadaconference.com. And now with all of that,
yeah, let's jump into things.
out of the way.
I want to jump into things. One of the things that we've been doing as we've been going through the Human Project, we have been talking about historical examples of dehumanization that are leading into conversations about humanization. And by the way, in the Human Project, you'll notice that this is the theme that happens. There are short videos that raise the dehumanizing question, and then there is teaching that allows you to discuss and work your way through that as you move into the humanizing process. And this is what we've called the Human Project. It's where we learn how to humanize both ourselves and other people, and we do that by getting our perspective of God straight. So to start, we've been, again, using these historical examples of what takes place when we don't have our perspective correct, mm-hmm. and leads into dehumanization. Now, the story that we want to look at today began in May 22nd, 1924. It's an interesting and terrible story about a 14-year-old boy by the name of Bobby Franks that vanished from the streets of Chicago. Now, at first glance, you wouldn't think that this would be, you know, a story that we would still be talking about. But in fact, this would go to become referred to as the crime of the century. And I hear that quite regularly, actually. This story continues to be talked about, continues to be published about. In fact, there have been a number of movies, including a Hitchcock movie that was made about this. There have been documentaries. There a number of different books that have been written about this, a lot of material that has talked about what took place when this young boy was abducted from the streets of Chicago. Now, shortly after his disappearance, there was a ransom note delivered to his parents demanding $10,000. And the parents were quite wealthy, and they were planning on paying that ransom to get their boy back. But before they could do that, Bobby's naked body was found on the outskirts of town. So this went from an abduction, you know, slash ransom to a homicide. And so as this case began to develop and they began to, you know, seek out what happened, you know, who did this, it ultimately led them to two figures, a guy by the name of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, who often are referred to as Leopold and Loeb. Now, they were 18 and 19 years old. And as this case began to unfold, what they realized is that these two men who eventually just confessed to doing it, and more than just confessing to it, they really enjoyed all the publicity that they received from this case and really bragged about what they had done. And ultimately, these were two really intelligent students. They had graduated from university. In fact, they had done so at like one of them, I can't remember now if it's Leopold or Loeb, but graduated university, the youngest that university has ever had graduate from there. I think his record still stands. Like, he graduated from college at like 14. They both went on to do master's degrees, one in law, one in history. And so here you have these two guys, they're intelligent, they're wealthy, and that didn't make sense of all this, right? Why are they demanding a ransom and even committing this murder? And then they proceed to explain what they did, that their desire was to commit the perfect crime. They wanted to abduct a person, then they wanted to tie a rope around their neck, and together they wanted to pull at either end of this rope until they killed the victim together. And in this way, they would both be experience killing the person, in this case Bobby Franks, and they would both be responsible for his death. And so again, this is what they bragged about planning, plotting, and doing. But what actually took place is they grabbed Bobby. He began to fight back. They ultimately hit him over the head with a chisel and then shoved a gag into his mouth. And they talk about how they put the gag too far down. Bobby ends up suffocating to death and dies before they are able to complete their plan. However, part of their idea of a perfect crime was to get a ransom and to collect that without getting caught. So this was kind of like a challenge for them. Now, ultimately, Bobby was already dead. You know, they go to try to do this ransom, and everything kind of unfolds from there, and they ultimately get caught. They made a number of errors in doing this.
Yeah. Just before you continue, I just want to quickly interject here, because I'm sure other listeners have noticed too, but they were well-educated and wealthy. They didn't really have anything lacking, because so often I hear from my atheist or other secular humanist friends that what will lead to utopia, or what will lead to human sort of moral perfection, if you will, is education and economics.
Yeah, this was Plato's idea as well, by the way.
Yeah.
If we could just educate people, you know, and if you just get economics to a certain place, you know, it's
going to be good. And very, very much the same thing in Confucianism, because I kind of grew up with that kind of mindset around me, right? And as far as Confucius was concerned, human nature was kind of like blank slate, if not basically good, and then you just fill it with something good, right? But one of the reasons that Confucianism failed was because it had a false view of human nature. Mm-hmm. I think that's why it failed. And I think this
is where you have this distinction between utopia and dystopia. And one of the big questions in the middle is human nature. Which directions do humans take things? Whether, you know, say take technology, for example, do they take technology to good places, or are they going to take technology to bad places? And what we've seen historically over and over again is that human nature leads to dystopia, not utopia.
Mm. With all this education that these guys had, they found some dangerous ideas, didn't they?
Yeah, and ultimately this is what's going to take place, because the question then becomes, well, what inspired these guys to do this? Like, where did they get the idea that this was acceptable? And ultimately what they found is the court case came out, and this, by the way, became an interesting court case, right? This is one of the reasons why it became the crime of the century, is they've confessed to the crimes. They've gloried in them, in fact. So what is the lawyer, the defense team, going to do to try to get these guys off, or to defend them in their actions? And ultimately what started coming out is that Leopold was obsessed with Friedrich Nietzsche. By the way, Nietzsche was a 19th century philosopher. And this philosopher had this understanding that the Enlightenment was this movement to mechanize the universe. And you see this mechanization, you know, taking place through science, the scientific method. And I'm not saying that pejoratively. No, nothing against science.
When you say it was a movement to mechanize the universe, what do you mean by that? Do you mean like that's how we are discovering the universe to be? That is how we're forming the conception of the universe, one in which everything works in a mechanical way.
Which often was referred to as the clockwork universe.
Okay.
And you got guys like Newton that come along and start to show mathematically that not only are these conceptual ideas that you have a mechanical universe, but it starts giving laws, you know, like laws of gravity or planetary motion, or these different laws showing, no, look, like it actually is a machine. It actually is a clockwork universe. And ultimately what happens then, not to get too complicated in this, but you got Friedrich Nietzsche that comes along and says, I see a problem with this mechanized universe that hasn't been discussed yet, and that is that ultimately says that God is dead. And by that, he doesn't mean that people have killed God, but that there's no room for God anymore. Like, what? You've got your laws of motion, right? Yeah. We're figuring out how this machinery works.
Yeah, God has become irrelevant culturally, right. Socially.
And there was an idea, too, that was, you know, that had been going on where, you know, that maybe God was a tinkering God. You know, that God, you know, the universe still needed God, you know, to wind up the clock or whatever.
Deism.
Right. And then so ultimately, you move to like deism, like you see in Voltaire. He'll argue and give a lot of apologetic arguments. In fact, that's where we get the watch argument, by the way, for the design. A lot of people think that came from Paley, but it precedes Paley. I've read Voltaire giving that argument. And that's the farthest back I've found it. So I'm guessing it started with Voltaire. And so that was an argument for deism. But the idea there being, Nietzsche's just basically saying, listen, there's no need for theism. There's no need for deism in a mechanized universe. It's all just physical. And if it's all just physical, it means that there's nothing beyond the physical. There's no non-physical. And if there's no non-physical, then God must be dead. God must not exist, is ultimately what he was getting at. And in that, just teasing out the idea that if God's dead because all non-physical things are dead, then that means anything else that's non-physical, such as meaning, purpose, and value, are also illusory.
In that kind of a worldview, what is morality, right? What is ethics? Like, if you can't ground value, meaning, purpose, you can't have moral values, moral meanings.
You can't have justice. You know, what do those things even look like without this sort of foundation? And this is one of the things that gets talked a lot about. And guys like Nietzsche began to give this argument that, well, if you can come to a place where you can begin to see this mechanized universe and you can begin to realize that you, you know, in many ways in understanding this, become your own God, you become what's referred to as an Übermensch. This means above human, or often called superhuman. Well, then you can see what others can't see, and that is that we live in a meaningless, valueless, mechanical universe.
Hello, nihilism.
Exactly, and this is the philosophy of nihilism, which again came from Nietzsche. Leopold then said, I'm going to embrace that philosophy, and he ends up referring to himself as a superhuman, and that he can see what others can't see. He ends up convincing Loeb that he too is a superhuman, and that they are intellectually superior to everyone else, in that they can see that everything is valueless, but the only value then that is in that valuelessness, Leopold argues, is pleasure. And so then ultimately he develops his own ethic from pleasure, and he explains to the courts that it gave him pleasure to take Bobby Frank's life, and that in fact they took Bobby Frank's life as a sort of scientific experiment to know what it's like to kill a human being, and that this is why they did it. And basically argued, now this is where things get interesting, this is where it becomes the crime of the century. They took the philosophy that was being taught in the university and they just acted on it and basically said, how are you going to tell me, convict me I'm wrong? If we live in, and this is ultimately Clarence Darrow, their lawyer, basically gives this argument where he says, and this, by the way, is an argument that goes back to an Enlightenment thinker by the name of Laplace. And ultimately, he just says, listen, if it's just a mechanical universe, it means it's just matter in motion. And if it's matter in motion, then Leopold and Loeb, and by the way, this is what's being taught at the university, right? So he's just saying, listen, it's being taught at the university. They just acted it out. So Clarence takes it one step further, right? Leopold's saying...
Sorry, Clarence was...
Their lawyer.
The lawyer, okay.
Okay, so Leopold's saying, listen, I killed Bobby Franks for pleasure. Clarence Darrow, their lawyer, takes it one step further and says... Yeah, he says he did it for pleasure, but really he did it because he was determined to do so. Because in a mechanical universe, not only is there no value, and so you can pretend to give it whatever value you want, such as pleasure, but he says, but at the end of the day, it's just springs and pulleys and energy and motion. They had no other choice but to kill Bobby Franks. In this mechanical universe, there is no such thing as free will.
We become just like everything else, right, as humans. I mean, we're just like any other animal that's been evolved.
Any other animal and any other object, really.
Object, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah, there becomes no difference between a watch and a human being. Yeah. Both of them had been winded up from the Big Bang explosion itself. And this is just matter in motion. This is like a billiard table playing out as balls are hitting other balls and heading in different directions. Mm-hmm. This is Laplace's argument. If you know the trajectory, if you know the velocity, and you could calculate all that, you would know exactly where every molecule is going and where it came from. Mm-hmm. And in that, there then is this argument, well, there is no such thing as free will. The universe just becomes one giant domino effect.
Yeah, and I've often used this illustration of dominoes, actually, to show that in a world like that, you can't have something like value, moral value, like good and evil. So think of two dominoes, A and B. Now, you have at least two scenarios, right? Either A falls and knocks B over, or vice versa. B falls and knocks A over. And when I teach on this stuff, I ask the question, well, which one of these scenarios is evil? Then people start chuckling because they can see that that question is absurd. There is nothing moral or immoral about it. It's a morally neutral event. It's just physics, blind physics. I'm like, right. So let's increase the number of dominoes to 10. Does anything change? No, it's just more of the same. Okay, a billion, trillion. And then I say, how about if we had 10 to the 80th power dominoes, which, by the way, I'm told is the number of all the elementary particles in our universe, right? It's just more of the same. So if that view, this kind of matter in motion kind of view is true, then everything is blind physics and you can't have something like good and evil.
So
well, let me just jump in here real quick because I know that we might have some science buffs that are going, yeah, but Steve, you haven't taken into account quantum mechanics and particularly quantum indeterminacy.
Mm-hmm. Quantum indeterminacy, I mean, that's just one of, I think, 10 interpretations of quantum mechanics that are all mathematically equivalent. So it's not like you can just take quantum indeterminacy, the Copenhagen theory, and just take it to the bank.
I would agree with you. That would be one reply to that. The reply that I often want to go to is just to say, okay, when I go to the local university and I hear the local philosophy prof or whoever speaking on this subject of determinism, what are they arguing? And what I have seen argued over and over again for a deterministic universe, even in light of quantum indeterminacy, is first of all, what you just said, well, we could call into question the Copenhagen interpretation, first of all. But then secondly, when the quantum level, as you begin to move up, everything begins to average out as the size gets larger.
Right.
So that once you get out of the quantum level, you're back into determinancy. And so they would say, yeah, sure, I could grant you that at the quantum level, I can't know with exact precision, but that just all averages out into larger objects such that it is absolutely deterministic once you get to right. the level of a human being.
I hope you can realize how detrimental this kind of thought going on here in the past, right? But what are the implications worldview, I guess.
This brings us then to the implications, and you see this with Clarence Darrow. He argues this in the court case. He says, quote, free moral agency is a myth, a delusion, and a snare. He goes on to say that science and evolution teach us that man is an animal. He is governed by the same natural laws that govern the rest of the universe. This is a key idea because I just want to mention this. Oftentimes, in our culture today, you will often find people such as PETA, you know, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, wanting to take a animal and raise them to the level of a human being and say, you know, look, you need to respect animals and you need to treat them with dignity and respect.
The same kind of dignity and respect that you would have for another human being.
Exactly. The problem is, though, is when they're doing this, they're basically taking the animal kingdom, they're taking natural laws, and they're applying those to a human being. And what happens is the whole thing collapses. You don't have animals coming to the level of a human being. You have a human being coming to the level of an animal. And this, to me, is where things get interesting. And that is that we understand, humans understand that we are accountable to a law above nature's law, that we follow rules of another kingdom other than the animal kingdom.
By natural law, I think you mean like physical laws, right?
Yeah. In that, just to be really specific, we don't hold animals morally accountable for their actions. We do not see animals as moral. So when you take an animal then and you begin to try to equate an animal with a human being, this collapses, right? So now you go back into this valueless, right, you know, amoral animal kingdom. This is what you're wanting to avoid in the first place. See, notice PETA is not boycotting orcas. You know, they're not angry with orcas for tail kicking. If you've ever seen this on National Geographic, it's fascinating. They can tail kick seals 90 feet in the air, and they enjoy doing it. They will go, they will grab baby seals, they'll throw them off the shore back into the water. They will tail kick them and do so. I think they think that they do it. A, it could just be out of pleasure, but they think they do it just to separate the meat and just to tenderize. And then once they've had their fun, they eat them. They even like body slam on top of these seals for a while, right? What does PETA think about that, right? Well, nobody's saying anything to the orcas about that because they know that they're orcas. But when you take an orca and you equate them to the level of a human being, do you notice what you're doing, right? You're taking the human kingdom and the animal kingdom and you're trying to equate the two. It collapses in on itself.
Yeah, just a quick interjection here. I've always found it fascinating that whenever we try to humanize animals, we only attribute those characteristics to animals that we like, that we find are really compassionate and human in a lot of ways, right? When you watch a movie like Babe, where this little pig is talking about, I mean, you don't
which we
see
call the, anthropomorphization.
Yeah, and you don't see this pig cannibalizing other pigs. That's one of the things that pigs do, but you won't see that because we are very selective when we.
I mean, you see this so much on Facebook right now, like with the little stories about the animals. And today I saw it looked like a seal doing crunches with a trainer, right? Mm-hmm. It's putting that human aspect into this seal. Right. I mean, we think it's funny, but there's something else going on there, right?
What it ultimately becomes is dehumanizing to human beings and dangerous, and actually does the exact opposite of what PETA is desiring to do, or people that follow in that line of wanting to treat animals ethically. You need to have an ethic in order to treat that animal ethically. And so in that reason, it is absolutely essential that you keep humanity distinct from animals. And ultimately what you've got with the Leopold and Loeb case is just saying, look, they're just mechanical. They're just animals. They're just determined to behave in these sorts of ways.
So are you saying that ethics is unique to humans?
Absolutely. The idea that we have an ethic, that we have a moral compass that tells us, and by that I want to be really specific, tells us that there are right and wrong ways to live in relationship with not only other human beings, but as a Christian, we would argue that there are right and wrong ways to live in relationship with other persons, such as God, such as each other, and animals and the environment itself. Mm-hmm. Now, persons, I don't want to ascribe to the environment, but I do want to say that God created the universe. Okay. And in that way, I respect the person of God by respecting what he created.
Just as we punish people for vandalism, right? Mm-hmm. The direct object against which the crime is committed is not a person, but it is tied to a person. And so that becomes mm-hmm. an offense. Now, the skeptic in me goes, but Andy, don't we see this kind of moral behavior in, you know, chimpanzees and bonobos and these social animals? You know, don't they have an ethic?
Right. And ultimately, to call that an ethic is where that would go awry. You know, if you want to give it an ethic, we've already given it an ethic. It's called survival of the fittest, right? Darwin gave it, you know, its ethic. And which is interesting, though, because that ethic is unacceptable to apply to human beings, but is fine to apply to the animal kingdom in general. Nobody is going and jailing bonobos for the way that they're behaving, because they understand they're behaving according to the animal kingdom and its laws, and in particular, the law of, you know, survival of the fittest. And so we intuitively understand that. Now, I do want to argue that I see that there is a progression, you know, moving from plants to animals into higher level of animals. You do see a progression in them of self-awareness of sorts, right? And you do see different characteristics that we ascribe, you know, significance to, that these are, you know, whether, you know, it's a bonobo that is loving its young or is using a tool to fish out, you know, if you want to call it that, which is highly debatable, right?
Whether,
you know, to fish out some ants. Yeah. If that's actually a tool or if that's just correlation, you know, those are up for debate. But I think that that's interesting. I think it's interesting that I don't have a problem stepping on a ant, but I would definitely not step on a bonobo. I think that that's interesting. I definitely think that there's something to that. I do find it interesting, though, that you – this is where, by the way, this argument really begins to fall down when people want to apply these kind of ethics to the animal kingdom. Right? Is because, you know, notice that they kind of want to move up the line to the bonobo. But once you get down to the squirrel, the slug, and the ant, you know, not really sure what to do there. One of the things often, too, that you'll hear is just this argument where they'll want to ground ethics into other natural ways, such as, you know, maybe we ground ethics according to how much DNA you have, you know, that's similar to a human being.
Right.
And this becomes that distinguishing factor.
Yeah, often the chimpanzee is brought up, right? Like they say 98% similarity.
Which, by the way, raises a big question. Who says?
Yeah, who says?
And what number?
Yeah, at what point are you going to draw the line? Why not, you know, why chimpanzees but not lilies?
Right.
Right?
And by the way, a human being shares 37%, you know, similarity of DNA with a lily. Or a dandelion, you know. Mm-hmm. Is that enough? Well, what you begin to see is that it becomes incredibly subjective. But we understand that justice isn't subjective, you know, because ultimately other people say, well, a government or a body of people, they agree together on what a moral standard looks like.
Yeah, cultural relativism, which is hugely problematic. You find that any kind of moral relativism ultimately boils down to moral nihilism, because moral relativism says, well, it's all relative, like there is no objective morality, right? So there you go, moral nihilism, really. All you have is subjective ones, but then all kinds of problems arise, like individual sort of moral relativism or subjectivism. I'm like, how are you going to condemn guys like Ted Bundy? Cultural relativism, how are you going to condemn countries like Nazi Germany that exterminated millions of people? How are you going to condemn King Leopold? You know, so on and so forth.
Which is interesting, though, Steve, because they would want to condemn those people, right? And so ultimately what you begin to see is that even though a country may even have laws that say, yeah, it is okay to exterminate Jews, right? We would still come in.
Or the Congolese.
Or the Congolese. We would still come in and say, no, that was wrong. And that's where trials like the Nuremberg trials or even trials like this one with Leopold and Loeb become interesting, because Leopold and Loeb were guilty. They were sentenced to life in prison for what they did, because ultimately, what did society say? What did the court say? Well, they said, listen, I know that might be being taught at the university, but you can't live that way. And so ultimately, you get this two worldviews going on. Right. And it's kind of like there's this what I often call cheating on your worldview. You got the worldview that's being taught at the university, and then you got the worldview that's being lived out. And ultimately what we got going right now, and this is again why this was called the crime of the century, is that we've got this dissonance that's taking place. This is what's being taught, but you're not allowed to live that way, which was the premise of this case. Notice in the Nuremberg trials, when Nazis take into court, ultimately they want to ground morality, that justice, outside of human beings. They want it to be objective. And by that meaning, a standard that's applied to everyone equally, that's not subjective.
The challenge in doing that is that if you ground morality and if that foundation is in us, then it becomes subjective, right?
That's right. Because you got people like Leopold and Loeb say, right, well, according to my pleasure, it's okay to kill Bobby Franks. Or you got people like Ted Bundy, who uses the same phrase, by the way. According to my pleasure, it was okay to rape and murder those women.
Then in order for morality to be objective, and I think we all experience morality this way, right? There is some kind of an objective reality to it, that there's this kind of moral reality that imposes itself on us in our moral experience. When we do something wrong, we often feel guilt. When we know we've done something wrong, we always feel guilt, right? Shame and things like that. And there's some kind of like, some kind of objective reality to it. So if morality is to be objective, then it has to be, the foundation of it has to be outside of humanity. And this is where I find that theists and atheists diverge. What atheists often say is that, well, that could be some kind of atheistic moral Platonism, that there are such things as goodness, evil, justice, and kindness.
If I could just jump in here, if you're unfamiliar with this, Platonism or Neoplatonism is this idea that goes back to non-physical things, that there are these non-physical things that in fact, under Plato's worldview, are more real than what we experience, so that there's this justice standard outside of people and we only see a shadow of it.
Right.
But this is a problem, right? Now you get that cheating on your worldview again, because you're trying to embrace a non-physical, physical reality simultaneously.
Now, granted, atheism doesn't have to be reduced down to physicalism, the idea that matter and motion is all we have in the world. And so some atheists will say, you know, there are such things as goodness and evil and all of these things that are just kind of outside of us. And when we act in conformity to those things, then our actions are good or evil and things like that. Now, the problem I find is, aside from the fact that, you know, the idea of just kind of kindness being there, it seems just bizarre to me, because, I mean, it makes sense for Terry to be kind, and he often is. But what does it mean for kindness just to be there?
An abstract object called kindness.
Yes.
We understand that these are person dependent.
Right. And further, another problem is, where is that compulsion coming from? Why should we act in accordance with justice rather than injustice, right? If Terry is acting in conformity to kindness and Andy is acting in conformity to, let's call it, jerkness, then, you know, which one is right? Right? Who gets to decide which one is better and not? And so I find that that's a bit of a problem whenever you try to ground morality on something that's impersonal. It just starts breaking down, because you realize that morality or ethics is an interpersonal thing. So
it's relational.
Right. Which is why I think for morality to make sense, its ultimate source has to be personal or interpersonal, which I think is where theism is.
In particular, Christian theism,
because there is the Trinity.
Exactly. And that this now, notice what this conversation, some people might be like, where is this conversation going? We're talking about how should humans live? So we understand that there is a moral, you know, an objective moral value or truth to the way that a human being should live in relationship with other human beings. Or let me put it this way, to be more specific, there is a way in which persons should live in relationship with other persons. This then is going to affect the way that you live in relationship with God, which will ultimately inform how you're going to live in relationship with people. And this will ultimately inform how you're going to live in relationship with nature Again, not because nature is a person, but because nature was created by a person, and in living in right relationship with that person will affect the way that you live in relationship to what that person created, what that person is seeking to do in the case of Christianity, with what is the purpose of this life? What is my purpose? Why am I here? And allowing that to inform who and what we are. That we are, as we talked about in the last session, we are made not only by God, but we're made in God's image, a relational image, an image of a triune God, a Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in whom becomes the standard of morality, in that God lives in right relationship within himself. God is the very standard of goodness or love in that way.
This might be a good place for us to then summarize everything. Right from the beginning, we talked about what is human, what is the value of human life, what leads to human flourishing, and today we talked about, well, how should humans live? I think we can bring those all together.
What we see that we've been talking about in this human project is the project of seeing our humanity and the humanity of others begins, as we've talked about, with seeing God correctly. And now what we've seen today is that when I take my focus off of God, I fall into nihilism. I fall into a deterministic worldview in which there is no such thing as moral values. There's no such thing as a right way that a human being should live in relationship, or a way persons should live in relationship with other persons. Mm. But when I get my perspective of God straight, it starts to inform who and what I am. In particular, in the first session, we talked about God having created human beings for the purpose of relationship, that we've been created to live in relationship with God. We've been created to live in relationship with one another. And it's not a one-way relationship. It actually starts with God, a God who loves you and created you for the purpose of relationship with himself and created you for the purpose of relationship with one another.
And that purpose defines what you are.
And it absolutely defines what you are, in that we are not just the particles that make us up, that we understand there's a difference between the parts that I'm made of and the purposeful whole that I'm made for. And so this begins to change the way that I see myself, that I am not just a bunch of stardust. I'm a human being made to be and to live in relationship. This then begins to inform my value, that I see that I'm made by God, and that I am his treasured possession, that my value is equal amongst all other human beings, and that we've all been made by God. And more than that, that we've been made in God's image, an image that doesn't come in degrees, nor can it be taken away. Notice then that this informs that we have inherent dignity or inherent value. It's a value that we come into the world with. No human being gave you value. You came into the world with value because that value came from God. It's an objective value, and a value that is, again, equal, objectively equal. And that ultimately it comes with, as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights declares, that we come into the world with inalienable rights, meaning rights that can't be taken away from you. And why is that? Why was it wrong for Leopold and Loeb to take away, you know, Bobby Frank's rights, right? And what we understand is that we were created by God according to his objective standard of how we should live in right relationship with one another, that ultimately leads to our flourishing. And we talked about that in session three, that we were created for relationship, but not just any kind of relationship. We understand that there's good relationship and there's bad relationship, like the way Leopold and Loeb were in relationship with Bobby Franks. Wasn't a good relationship. That there is a way that human beings are to live, or the way that humans should live with one another, that informs or is being informed by who God is, and that this ultimately is what's going to lead to our flourishing, in that we fulfill the purpose that we were created for. Now, as you go through the Human Project, and we pray that you would get a hold of that resource, we go into more of this humanization aspect. What does this look like to live out this human project, as particular as we see in that in our brokenness, we are a sinful, broken, evil people that are bent, as the Bible tells us, towards breaking relationship. And that ultimately we need help if we are going to be restored in such a way that we can understand and live in right relationship with one another. That's ultimately going to require not only that I see God correctly, but that God's going to need to do a work in me through the person of Jesus Christ. And this is going to then inform and to help me to live as a human being and to experience a flourishing life as I live the way that I was created for.
All right. What a journey it has been over the last four podcast episodes. Listeners, I hope you found this very helpful. Make sure you go to thehumanproject.ca and check out our resource, and it'll be launching again at our Apologetics Canada conference on March 2nd and 3rd, and the Human Project will be made available then. And so keep your eyes peeled for that. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more stuff to think about. Ciao for now.